Dan Bernstein, Lecture 5. Proving primality more quickly.
For instance, if you try actually proving the primality of a moderately large number with that method, it scales okay, but we have better ways to prove primality. And I want to tell you about the state of the art in this talk. Let me begin by reviewing why you don't want to bother proving primality. You can convince yourself that a number is prime without having a primality proof. As you've heard, you can just do a Fermat-type test. If you have a prime number n and b, just think b equals 3, for instance, then certainly by Fermat's little theorem, 3 to the n minus 3 is a multiple of n. It's in nz. Well, b to the n minus b, you can actually say a little bit more by factoring b to the n minus b, not putting a lot of work into it, but looking at b to the n minus b, depending on how many powers of 2 are in n minus 1, there's some really obvious factors of b to the n minus b. For example, suppose that n minus 1 is divisible by 4, but not by 8, so n is 5 plus 8 times something, then n is prime. If n is prime, then if you have an integer b, like 3, I suppose 3 wouldn't be a multiple of n. In general, b, if b is any integer, it's going to be a multiple of n, or b to the n minus 1 over 2 plus 1 will be a multiple of n, or b to the n minus 1 over 4 plus 1, or b to the n minus 1 over 4 minus 1. One of those has to be a multiple of n, because if you multiply them together, let's do that, b to the n minus 1 over 4 plus and minus 1 multiplied gives b to the n minus 1 over 2 minus 1, times b to the n minus 1 over 2 plus 1 is b to the n minus 1 minus 1, times another b is b to the n minus b. So here are four numbers that their product, b to the n minus b, is divisible by n, since n is prime, and therefore the prime has to divide at least one of the factors. In general, you've already heard the notion of a strong probable prime is the usual official abbreviation for SPRP, strong probable prime. Actually, I prefer the expansion strong perhaps prime. Probable doesn't have a really solid meaning in this context, so okay, an integer could be a prime if it's a b strong perhaps prime, so like a 3 strong perhaps prime. That means that n is in this situation. If n is not necessarily prime, well, if you don't know anything about n, but it does satisfy the conclusions there, if it divides one of the obvious factors of b to the n minus b, depending on the powers of 2 dividing n, then we call n a b strong probable prime. And certainly, if n is prime, then it has to divide one of those factors, because it divides the product, b to the n minus b. If n is composite, well, it could also be a b SPRP. But every composite number has lots of witnesses to its compositeness, has lots of b's. You've probably heard the number 3/4 of the b's out there. 3/4 of the b's not divisible by n have n not being a b strong perhaps prime. So if you have a composite number n, well, I'll get to it in a moment, how you prove it's composite by looking for b. You can actually go further and not just these are theorems. What I'm saying here so far is easy facts about the number of b's for which n is not a b strong perhaps prime, the SPRP. But you can actually go further and just on the computer say, hey, I'll try a bunch of composite numbers, and you find that almost all the big numbers you write down are 2 SPRPs if and only if they're prime. Okay, you can find counterexamples to that without much work, and I think, in fact, you've heard a pretty big number, which is a 2 SPRP, which is kind of malicious and makes itself a 2 SPRP, a 3 SPRP, and a bunch more SPRPs. But there's actually a somewhat more complicated test, what's called a BPSW620PRP, for which we don't know any composite numbers that satisfy that test. It's something that's easy to compute, like computing b to the n something minus 1 modulo n, just a single exponentiation, basically. Well, this is maybe a few exponentiations. It's a somewhat more complicated test to write down, but once you've written it down, it's something that every prime satisfies, and no composite numbers that we know of, despite massive searches, no composite numbers satisfy this test. As a practical matter, if somebody gives you a big random number and it passes this test, you are very confident that it's a prime number. However, we believe that there's infinitely many composite numbers that are BPSW620PRPs. Question? What's the 620 dollars doing in there? That's not the base for the perhaps prime test. There is a reward of $620 for anybody who can prove or disprove the statement here, if you got rid of the known word. So if you find a composite number that is a BTSW 620 PRP and prove that it's a composite number, that's easy to do in the way that I'm about to say, and well, with these PRP tests, but also prove that it is a BTSW 620 PRP, I think you're also required to exhibit the factorization of it. But if you come up with an example here, you get $620. Or if you prove that actually no composites satisfy this test, if you prove that actually what we think about this is not true, then you also get $620. That's probably much harder. I would put my bets on what people conjecture is true. There's a reasonable argument for why there should be composite numbers that satisfy this test, even though we're having a lot of trouble finding them. The $620 actually comes from three people, one of whom offers $20, one of whom offers $100, and one of whom offers $500. The person offering $500, well, the person offering $20 is an analytic number theorist who's convinced that there are exceptions to this. That's Pomeranz. The person offering $500, that's Wagstaff, who would be impressed by the computation. And then in the middle, there's Selfridge. B is Bailey, who initiated this line of thought of trying to come up with a really reliable test this way. And in practice, again, this is a very reliable test. Look up the details. If you have some big number that you want to just check for primality and say, hey, if somebody beats this test, they get $620, this is a good test to use. Anyway, if you do the proof, then suddenly Pomeranz is surprised and he gives you $500, whereas Wagstaff is unimpressed by proofs and will give you only $20. And Selfridge in the middle will give you $100. All right, so this is how cash rewards work in number theory. Without relying on any conjectures about primality, suppose you actually had one of these exceptions or you're just worried about maybe there's an exception, you want to guarantee, okay, we can prove every composite number composite, then the way you do it is you take your input number n, at least 2, and just try a bunch of b's. Try some random b modulo n. And if n is not a BSPRP, then n cannot be prime, because every prime is a BSPRP for every b. If you find that n is a BSPRP, then you repeat. This algorithm, if you give it a composite number, well, I said, theorem, that every composite number has most of the b's you try and will be a BSPRP. And therefore, this algorithm will repeat only a few times. On average, something like 1.5 times. Well, it should be 1 divided by 1 minus 3 quarters at most. And, well, there's not very many repetitions, not very many b's you have to try on average. Unless you get unlucky, you might have to try several b's. And if you run the algorithm a whole bunch of times, then sometimes the algorithm won't be so lucky. And it will eventually come up with a compositeness proof for any composite number. And it's easy to say what the average time is. But, well, again, you could get unlucky and have to run it, say, 20 times. That's not so inconceivable to get unlucky 20 times. Getting unlucky 40 times, that would be extremely difficult. You'd have to be really, really unlucky. You'd have to have something like my laptop's random number generator to fail that many times. Anyway, this algorithm will provably find a certificate in time. What's this log n to the 2 plus little o of 1? That's the asymptotic speed using fast multiplication for really big numbers n. That's the speed of doing an exponentiation, which is all that these powers of b modulo n boil down to. The random cost here, well, you have to generate b randomly, and then that's the average time over the random choices of b that you make before you find a certificate. Once you've found the b, once you've found, so b here, this proof that n is composite, that's the certificate here. If you want to check their certificate, you can save somebody the effort of finding the b, trying a few b's where the first one might fail, first few might fail. You just give them the b, and then this becomes a deterministic algorithm to verify that n is composite. Yeah.
Can you construct numbers that will resist this test?
Can you construct numbers that will resist this? No. Every composite number will have most b's. If you choose b's randomly, then at least 75% of the b's not divisible by n, take b's between 1 and n minus 1, at least 75% of those will prove n composite, if in fact it is composite. You can make a number, I think you heard last week, about a number that is 2 SPRP, 3 SPRP, etc. But if you choose b's randomly, then somebody who's maliciously making a composite number that's BSPRP for his b's won't know what your b's are.
Can you easily, if you know that the person's going to use, if you know what b's the other person's going to use, can you easily construct a number that will
be? Oh, yeah. So the question is, if you know the b's, can you construct a number n, a composite number that passes those b's. And that's about the same problem as doing it for the first b's, like 2 and 3 and so on. And that's something where for a surprisingly large number of b's, yes, you can, although n has to grow with the number of b's. If you get more b's than the sort of, I think the size where you can reasonably do it is about the log of n. If the number of b's is about the log of n, you can make an n about that size where it passes any selected set of b SPRPs. If you have more than logarithmic number of b's, then that becomes difficult.
And can you make the n in an intelligent way rather than kind of...
Can you make the n in an intelligent way for a bunch of b's? Yes. You can look at b's and figure out in advance some n's that will work well for that. However, if somebody doesn't know which b's you use, this algorithm, when you're generating random numbers, presumably somebody gives you n as input, and then you call on the user to flip coins for you, and hopefully he's doing it reliably. The question of how you come up with random numbers is certainly one that's a thorn in the side of cryptography, as you heard in the public lecture, that actually coming up with a random number and not accidentally reusing the same random number for everybody, that is sometimes something that people fail at. But okay, we can analyze the algorithm, assuming that there's a source of new independent random numbers coming into it. Okay, I stated at the bottom of this slide an open question, which is, can you get better than exponent 2? For instance, can you have a verifiable compositeness certificate in essentially linear time? And, well, if I didn't have another restriction here, you'd say, oh, yeah, of course. Here's a compositeness certificate for n, a factor of n. That's a very easy way to convince somebody that n is composite, is give them a factor. And then they do the division and see, oh, yeah, it exactly divides, so n is composite. But that's a certificate that takes a very long time to find. And here, the open question is, can you somehow come up with a certificate that is findable in polynomial time and verifiable in essentially linear time? The best we have, if I change this polynomial time for finding a certificate, if I change that to the speed of the number field sieve, that's how quickly we can find an essentially linear time verifiable certificate. But getting down to polynomial time, well, maybe there's some other way to certify compositeness, which doesn't involve coming up with a factor, so this is maybe not as hard as polynomial time factorization. Anyway, it's an open question right now. What if you have a prime number? Well, you run this algorithm, and of course it does not succeed in proving that your prime number n is composite, so it keeps going forever and ever and ever, trying a bunch of b's, and after you get through 100 b's, then you are super confident, again, assuming you have really random numbers coming in, you are super confident that n is prime, but you have not actually mathematically proven that n is prime. And I've got three categories of people who might ask whether you need to have a proof that n is prime, or if you're satisfied with the quadratic time algorithm to check if n is prime. In cryptography, if you look at all the other things we're doing in cryptography where we're not too worried about being extremely unlucky, we just say, well, if you're extremely unlucky, too bad for you. The rest of us are not so unlucky, and we're just going to go ahead with cryptography. There's so many spots in cryptography where you have to allow for the possibility of being extremely unlucky and say, okay, we're just going to assume that doesn't happen. The fact that you might accidentally be unlucky in checking a prime is not something that bothers people familiar with cryptography. On the other hand, there are some people who are a bit confused about how cryptography works, and they write all sorts of cryptographic standards where they say, oh, here's exactly what you're supposed to do to make sure that you're not doing anything wrong, and they go through the literature thinking of anything that might go wrong and looking at anything in a paper that sounds like it might be something going wrong, like, oh my God, this test doesn't perfectly reliably tell us if the number is prime. What do we do? Well, you need to have a proof that the number is prime, and there's standards that insist on having proofs. There's standards, there are people publishing proofs in standards, in financial standards, that particular big numbers are prime. So, okay, there are some people who apparently think that this is a good thing to prove primality, even though you're totally convinced, having run the SPRP test, you're totally convinced the number is prime. These people are not satisfied with that. They want the primality proof. Ignoring the applications here, you can say, hey, as computational number theorists, okay, this is a workshop on summer school on computational number theory and applications to cryptography. And for the first part of that, for computational number theory, proving primality is fun. We saw one of the recent methods last time, and it's interesting, the techniques that go into it. And there's actually a bunch more techniques that go into it, which I would like to survey for the rest of my talk. I said yesterday a recent algorithm that takes time 6th power of log n. If you're trying to prove that n is a prime, then this algorithm takes time 6th power of log n. And, we can't quite prove that. This is the conjectured cost of this deterministic algorithm for proving primality. The output of the algorithm is a primality proof. And when I say a primality proving algorithm, I mean something that outputs a mathematical proof of primality. Those of you familiar with the definition of NP might realize that proof and certificate are slightly different concepts. But for me, in this talk, every algorithm we have that generates what we can prove are certificates is also an algorithm that generates proofs. So anyway, this particular algorithm produces as output a proof that n is prime, or if n is composite, it'll also tell you that, but that's the relatively easy part. We can prove, there's two levels of proofs here. There's the proofs of primality, and then there's the proofs of the algorithm speed. We can prove that this primality proving algorithm takes at most log n to the 10.5 time, or easier theorem, at most log n to the 16.5 time with a simpler algorithm. We conjecture it takes 6th power time, and now you might reasonably ask, can we do better than 6th power time? One way that this algorithm has been improved with a lot more effort, which I won't try to summarize aside from the result, is that the gap between the proven cost and the conjectured cost has been eliminated. There's a fancier algorithm that takes x to the q minus 1 and complicates that polynomial, and with a lot of work ends up proving, okay, here's a more complicated algorithm that's guaranteed to take time at most the 6th power of log n. For proven deterministic primality proving algorithms, that's the best we know how to do. So for example, it is not known if there's a primality proving algorithm for which the proven cost, nobody's been able to come up with a primality proving algorithm and prove that the cost of that algorithm, deterministic cost, no randomness allowed in the algorithm, is at most the 5th power of log n, or 5.5, anything below 6. Yeah?
Why is it combinatorial?
Well, there's no standard name for these AKS kind of tests yet, but I think of these tests as doing a lot of combinatorial enumeration of how many products there were, those x minus 6 times x minus 9 and so on. There were 2 to the 3,364 of those products, and then if you try to push the same techniques further and streamline the test, then you end up doing a little more complicated combinatorics to count how many products and similar objects there are. So I think of these as combinatorial primality proofs. This idea of writing down a bunch of useful products is something that I think of as being a combinatorial process. There's a combinatorial explosion in the number of products. But anyway, this is just my private terminology. There's no standard name for these aside from, okay, they're AKS type tests. Without that restriction on whether it's combinatorial or not, just coming up with any algorithm where the proven speed of proving primality with no randomness is below 6th power, that's an open problem. But the game changes considerably once you allow randomness. There's another direction that this algorithm has been developed, which also plays around with the x to the q minus 1, not in such a complicated way, the proof's not so hard. And this algorithm has a total cost of log n to the 4th. That's a random cost. You might have to look around for a little while before you find the certificate of primality. But once you come up with a certificate, you can verify it in time log n to the 4 plus little o of 1. So that's the proven random cost of a primality proving algorithm along the lines of the algorithm that I said last time. And if you're willing to say, okay, we'll flip coins in order to come up with our primality proof, but then once we have it, we can show it to somebody and they'll verify that proof in time log n to the 4th, that's quite a lot better than the log n to the 6th. The only problem is coming up with the random numbers. You might figure, okay, the algorithm will probably work fine if you come up with numbers 1, 2, 3, etc. It's an ERH kind of question that you heard about last week to remove the randomness from this algorithm. We can't do better than 4, so that 4 is the state of the art for randomized primality proving algorithms. We don't have a primality proving algorithm whose proven speed is at most log n cubed. We don't even have a primality proving algorithm that anybody believes takes time at most log n cubed, log n to the 3 plus epsilon. As epsilon, as n goes to infinity, the epsilon converges to 0. We don't have an algorithm that can be reasonably conjectured to have that speed. For proven deterministic algorithms, random implies conjectured deterministic, because you can always feed a random number generator, deterministic random number generator, into your algorithm. It would not be reasonable for me to formulate that last open question in the deterministic context. We do have an algorithm, namely the random one, which gets proven, conjectured deterministic cost log n to the fourth. But if you're not worried about deterministic versus random, then the state of the art is 4, and we don't know how to get below 4. We don't know how to prove primality in cubic time.
What about Miller-Raven? I mean, that's assuming some ERH, right? So these are
correct. Miller-Raven does not produce a proof of primality. Miller-Raven produces a proof that if ERH is true, then your number is prime.
So it's conditional rather than proven.
Correct. At which point it's conditional rather than proven was the comment. And yes,
so
that's the point where the bankers say, "Okay, please show me a proof of ERH."
So it depends on your religion, right? Whether you believe ERH or not. You believe ERH.
Well, even if you believe ERH, okay, I believe ERH is true.
Right.
Nevertheless, Miller-Raven does not output a primality proof because Miller-Raven does not have a proof of ERH. Even though we believe ERH is true, it's not meeting the standard of producing a primality proof that somebody can verify until somebody proves ERH. So there's a challenge for all you to improve primality proving algorithms. And then actually Miller-Raven, if you look at it, takes time log n to the fourth. So it's not better than the algorithms that I'm talking about taking quartic time. But let me get into what we can do with those kinds of algorithms. Even if we don't have a proof of ERH, we can say, all right, let's just verify ERH for all the integers n we care about. For instance, somebody went through all the integers n from 2 up through 2 to the 48 and checked that each one of those integers was prime if and only if it was a small list of SPRPs, 2 SPRP, 3 SPRP, 5, 7, 11, 13, and 17. Now, this computation was quite a bit of work. Getting up to 2 to the 48 and doing a fair amount of computation for each of those numbers, actually it was a little more subtle than that, but still that computation took quite a lot of work. On the other hand, once you've done that work, you can reuse it for any number of n's. Imagine you're trying to prove primality not just of one n, but of a bunch of n's. Then maybe you can afford this computation. And well, the world has afforded this computation. It's done now. We know that every integer n up to 2 to the 48 is prime if and only if it satisfies this easily verifiable condition. The time for this type of algorithm, we believe, is at most cubic in log n. That's the time for primality proof after massive pre-computation. It might even be possible to prove this. I don't think anybody's written down a proof of this, but I won't state it as an open question to prove this log n cubed after massive pre-computation. The game people then play is, how massive does the pre-computation have to be? You heard last week about pseudo-squares primality tests. For instance, here's a particularly interesting primality test from the pre-computation perspective, just because of how far it went, how huge the numbers n are that this test can handle. Integers n, as much as 100 bits long, can be easily tested for primality by a pseudo-squares primality test. An integer n up to 2 to the 100 is prime if and only if, well, do some exponentiations just up to 367. There's not too many primes up to that. And then also check the results of the exponentiation a little more carefully. And you can read the results here. Again, I think you heard about this type of test in some detail last week. You also have to check that n is not a square, cube, etc. And you have to check that n does not have any small prime divisors, which you can do very quickly because 2 to the 20 is so small, using, for instance, Pollard's row method. The conjectured cost of scaling this algorithm is the same as the log n cubed that we think for this SPRP type test. Sort of doing, here's the you were asking about Miller-Raven, and the SPRP type tests are trying to optimize Miller-Raven with proving something better than ERH by pre-computation. The pseudo-squares tests get the same cubic time speed for verifying primality, but the computation, the advantage of the pseudo-squares test, is that the computation is quite a lot less serious. as you can see, from the 2 to the 48 up to 2 to the 100. Maybe there was a little more computer time that went into the computer power on the right side. The pseudo-squares primality test involved this huge computation by Williams and Wooding of the pseudo-squares up to 2 to the 80. And that is something that was just barely doable and is enough with the 2 to the 20 here to get n's up to 2 to the 100. Somehow there's lots of extra streamlining that can happen on the right side that we don't know how to do on the left side. We don't know how to get Miller-Rabin or SPRP-type tests that prove primality up to anywhere near 2 to the 100 after reasonable computation, reasonable pre-computation. So that's the advantage of the pseudo-squares test. And you can ask for lots of these things to be better. You can ask, for example, for a test that instead of taking cubic time, conjecturally, cubic time after pre-computation, I've changed the exponent to a 2 there. Can you come up with an algorithm that after doing a ton of work, looking at every n if you like, after that can say, for here's a particular n, that yes, that n is composite, or yes, that n is prime, the time for that algorithm is at most quadratic in log n instead of cubic. That's something we don't know how to do. I should say, pre-computation, if you want definitions of exactly what the pre-computation is allowed to produce, for instance, can you make a big table of all the primes up to 2 to the 100? No, you're not allowed to, because when people are precisely defining pre-computation algorithms, non-uniform algorithms, they say you're not allowed to use a ton of memory for the result of the pre-computation. And that's a reasonable restriction. We cannot, in fact, write down all the primes up to 2 to the 100. You could also ask for an algorithm that has even less pre-computation than the algorithms we have now. There's been a lot of improvements in the pre-computation, but it's still something on the scale of n pre-computation to get up to n. When n is 2 to the 100, that's been streamlined so much that it's just barely doable, even though we certainly can't count up to 2 to the 100 on current computers. Nevertheless, the pre-computation in the pseudo-squares test is doable. Maybe we could get a lot further with some method that does only square root of 2 to the 100. Square root of 2 to the 200, maybe, pre-computation? Is there a primality-proving algorithm with conjectured cubic time cost for each n after you've done only a square root of n pre-computation? The last open question I've formulated here, presumably harder but slightly different flavor, is instead of doing pre-computation and then handling a bunch of n's one at a time, suppose you're given all the n's at once. Suppose you have a polynomial number, log n to the big O of 1, polynomial number of inputs, all about the same size, say all 512 bits, and then you want to check if they're all prime. Can you figure out which ones are prime or prove primality of all of them in less than or equal to cubic time per input? Having a whole bunch of inputs at once is kind of like the pre-computation question, but maybe you can do more interesting things, like remember remainder trees or sieving. These are ways to handle a whole bunch of inputs at once. They're not pre-computation algorithms, but they have something of the same flavor of handling a lot of inputs surprisingly quickly. All right, my last big section of types of primality proofs is primality proofs using curves. And these are also trying to get close to the cubic time performance that we hope for primality proofs that's currently open. Let me start with the first paragraph here for what's achieved by fast ECPP, fast elliptic curve primality proving. Mm-hmm. This is an algorithm that will produce a certificate that proves the primality of n. If you like, you could expand the certificate out into a proof whose length is, well, I'll get to the length in a moment, but the time to find the certificate is at most quartic in log n. We can't actually prove that. It's just a conjecture. So this might sound worse than the quartic time algorithms that we already have, like Miller-Rabin or the AKS variants that take quartic time. The advantage of this method is the length of the proof. The time to verify a certificate is at most cubic. So this does get down to cubic time. There's a cubic time, cubic length primality proof, which relies on a quartic time computation. At least we conjecture it relies on a quartic time computation. The algorithm I'm going to show you, nobody can even prove that it works for every n, let alone that it works at time log n to the fourth. But we nevertheless have no way to find an n where it fails. There's very solid reasons for believing this conjecture. We believe this algorithm always works. If you feed it a prime number, in practice it always does give you a certificate that you can then deterministically verify. You have a proof whose length is cubic in log n, a proof of the primality of n. If you don't like conjectures, if you want to say, is there a proven cost of cubic to verify a primality proof which can be generated in polynomial time? Forget about the four, but insist on proving the result. You can do that using genus 2 hyperelliptic curves, as you were hearing, for example, this morning. You can use Jacobians of genus 2 hyperelliptic curves with something like elliptic curve primality proving, same basic idea. A lot slower because hyperelliptic curves are a lot more difficult to work with, at least efficiently, but nevertheless, you can prove that the computation takes polynomial time using some randomness, like looking around for witnesses B's for BSPRP tests. This has the same feature of you have to look around for witnesses to the primality of N for appropriate curves, but you can prove that actually most curves you look at will work. And once you've actually found a curve that works, a genus 2 hyperelliptic curve that works, then you can give somebody a very quickly verifiable certificate, cubic time, which is still not as good as the quadratic time we've heard before for proving compositeness, but it's not too far off. Another variation of elliptic curve primality proving is getting the verification time down to quadratic, just as fast as compositeness proving. I'm suppressing lots of information when I write an exponent plus little o of 1. I'm suppressing all sorts of extra log-log factors, for example. And I don't mean to suggest that this particular algorithm is actually as fast. It might be some log-log factors slower. It might be 100 times slower. But nevertheless, at least at first glance, this algorithm is as fast as compositeness proving using the SPRP test. It's quadratic, essentially quadratic time. As n gets bigger, the exponent converges to 2, essentially quadratic time in the number of bits of n. On the other hand, this certificate is not something we know how to find quickly. We can prove it exists, but we don't know how to find that certificate quickly. In the case of factorization, you can, in the case of compositeness proving, by factoring numbers, you can come up with a very quickly verifiable, not just quadratic time, but essentially linear time, certificate of compositeness, and that's open for primality certificates. If you're not worried about the time to find a primality proof, then you can reasonably ask, can you do better than quadratic, like we can for compositeness? There are compositeness certificates, namely factors, that are verifiable in essentially linear time. We don't have primality certificates that work that quickly. All right, everything else that I want to tell you before stopping, hopefully on time, is about how this fast ECPP works. I think before I get into that, I'd like to very briefly pause and ask what the soccer score is.
Germany, Argentina.
1-0 Argentina.
Ooh. Okay, Argentina 1-0. We might have a pause later in the talk. So how do fast ECPP proofs work? Well, the basic idea you heard last week, and let me repeat it. This is like the Pocklington test. You heard some elliptic curve lectures, all sorts of information about elliptic curves, including the basic idea of how you prove primality using elliptic curves. If you have an elliptic curve mod n, if you have a positive integer n, well, bigger than 1, an elliptic curve mod n, which has a point of known prime order, well, even unknown prime order, but if you actually want to prove things, you have to prove Q is prime recursively. If you have a point on a curve mod n whose order is a prime Q that's bigger than a certain quantity that I'll try to carefully explain later on this slide, then n has to be prime. Now, there's lots of questions that you can reasonably ask here, like what exactly is an elliptic curve mod n? If you don't know, if you haven't proven n is prime, then what does it mean to have points on elliptic curves? What is an elliptic curve mod n? There are sensible mathematical answers to this. There are also lots of oversimplified answers to this, one of which I hope to show you as how this test actually works. But let's ignore the question of definitions and have some intuitive idea of, okay, elliptic curves are some things you can write down, some sort of polynomial rational things modulo n. If you have an elliptic curve with a point of big prime order, then n itself has to be prime, a point on an elliptic curve mod n. The way the proof works is as follows. Once you have actual careful mathematical definitions of elliptic curves over arbitrary rings, or at least rings like z mod n, then this actually turns into a correct proof. If you take any prime divisor of p mod n, then you can reduce your elliptic curve points mod that same p. Elliptic curve points, think of them as you have x comma y satisfying some equation, y squared equals x cubed plus whatever. If you take that equation mod n and reduce it mod p, where p is any divisor of n, but particularly primes, then you get an equation mod p on the same elliptic curve mod p. If you look at the same point of prime order mod p, then you can, from the appropriate definition of prime order in elliptic curves mod n, you can deduce that the point has prime order also mod p. Here I'm relying on the fact that q is prime. If you take q times the point and then reduce that modulo p, that's the same as reducing the point modulo p and then taking q times it. Since q is prime, the only possible orders of the point are q and 1. And, well, if what I just said about mod n versus times q tells you that the point mod p times q is the point at infinity, but the point itself being a point of prime order modulo n, not a point of order 1, has to be an affine point mod n, also an affine point mod every p dividing n, and therefore does not have order 1. It's not the point at infinity. So here's the spot where the inequality on q kicks in. If you believe that you have a point mod n, which has big prime order, and therefore has big prime order mod every p dividing n, how big can orders be on an elliptic curve mod p? Well, the number of points on an elliptic curve mod p is at most p plus 1 plus 2 repeat. And let's compare that to the order of this particular point on the curve, which is q, which is greater than the square of the ceiling of n to the 1 quarter plus 1. You don't have to have the ceiling in there for this theorem, but I put it in to make this something that you can compute easily. If q is bigger than this and less than or equal to the number of points of E of Fp, which is less than or equal to the square of square root of p plus 1, getting rid of the squares in that inequality, subtracting off 1, and squaring, you easily see that n to the 1 half is less than p. Every prime divisor of n is bigger than the square root of n, so n has to be prime. When people actually do these computations, they do something that does not rely on the definition of elliptic curves or elliptic curve point operations modulo n. What they do is write down some reasonably simple equations like what I'm showing you here. You're given a number n you're trying to prove is prime. It's an odd integer, bigger than 1. Even integers try to avoid proving that they're prime. Well, if it's equal to 2, I assume you can handle that by yourself. You're given an elliptic curve, y squared equals x cubed plus ax squared plus x, specified by the one coefficient there, a, that is not equal to 1 necessarily. A is some integer given as input. That's specifying a curve. B is specifying also a bit more of the curve and the coefficient of y squared and a point on the curve. I'll get to this on the next slide, the connection between this and the curve interpretation. You're also given, or you can just check, that n has no factors in common with b cubed plus ab squared plus b and a squared minus 4. Easy computations to do. And again, I'll come back to how those connect to elliptic curve facts. And you're given a prime number q bigger than the same about square root of n. You can then do this computation, which you might recognize as a computation you've seen before. The most streamlined formulas we have, well, I showed it before in the case b equals 2. These are the Montgomery shape elliptic curve point multiplication formulas, starting from a point whose x-coordinate is x1 over z1, b divided by 1. Doing this computation of x2i, x2i plus 1, z2i, z2i plus 1, for various i's, you eventually get to xq and zq. And then I claim that if zq is a multiple of n and XQ is relatively prime to N, which in a moment I'll connect up to having a point of order Q modulo N, then N is prime. All right, lots of formulas which relate to the elliptic curves as follows. If you have a prime number P that divides N, then, well, one of the conditions I wrote down here was that A squared minus 4 is relatively prime to N, and therefore, for any P that divides N, A squared minus 4 is non-zero modulo P. And same for BQ plus AB squared plus B. And that's enough to guarantee, if you remember the definition of an elliptic curve in terms of the discriminant, it's enough to guarantee that BQ plus AB squared plus B times Y squared equals XQ plus AX squared plus X is an elliptic curve mod P. It doesn't have singularities. B comma 1, plug in for X and Y, you see that B comma 1 is a point on that curve. And the whole point of these XI and ZI formulas is that XI divided by ZI is the x-coordinate. That was the idea of Montgomery arithmetic. You're just working with x-coordinates. Montgomery arithmetic on elliptic curves doesn't ever write down the y-coordinates of points on the curve. XI over ZI is the x-coordinate of the ith multiple of the point you started with on the curve, assuming that division makes sense, assuming ZI is non-zero mod p. If ZI is 0 and XI is not 0 mod p, then the ith multiple of the point you started with, B1, is the point at infinity. I left out a case here that XI is 0 and ZI is 0, which can happen. In the context of elliptic curve method factoring for a specific B, I don't know how to make that happen, but in this context, when you allow enough Bs, it's possible for XI to be 0 and ZI to be 0, in which case I'm not making any claims about what I times the point is. Doesn't that only happen when the curve singular mod p? No, you can just get in trouble because of the shape of the formulas. The formulas here don't have any inversions. They also don't have any checks against zero. And if you look at all the definitions of elliptic curve operations, you see there's always checks of whether something's zero, then you have to do some other operations. And it's possible if you don't do those checks, then depending what b is, you might end up with both xi and zi being zero, even if you don't have the point at infinity. I won't make any claims about what I times B comma 1 is in that case. The claim that I made on the left side says if ZQ is a multiple of N and XQ is relatively prime to N, then N is prime. Well, modulo P saying ZQ is a multiple of N means ZQ is also multiple of P. It's 0 mod P. Saying XQ is relatively prime to N says that mod P, XQ is non-zero. Therefore, we're in the second case of the inductive claims, Q times the original point must be the point at infinity on the curve. Coming back to my original explanation, I said, well, you take a point whose order is Q on this curve. And modulo each prime P dividing N, this point does have order Q. It's an affine point, doesn't have order 1. But if you multiply it by Q, you get the point at infinity, which is 0 in the elliptic curve group. And then all the logic about comparing the size of Q to the size of the possible elliptic curve orders mod P, where P is a divisor of N, work in exactly the way I said for the general idea of the theorem. You easily deduce that N is prime. Now, I've simplified this beyond what anybody's actually proven. You have to be a little bit careful about all those zeros that might show up. If you look at the definition of elliptic curves, then okay, I've made some claims here, and actually I think they're true, but I have not written down proofs yet, something I'm working on right now, but ran out of time to finish it this week. There's a whole bunch of cases to check in the elliptic curve formulas. In particular, keeping track of when you get to zeros, what happens after that, gets a little bit tricky, but I'm pretty sure it can be done, and I believe the resulting claims will be exactly what I said. This is not what you'll find when people carefully state elliptic curve proofs before now. So I might be oversimplifying things. Let me tell you what people actually do. The definition of elliptic curve operations mod N looks kind of like the definition of elliptic curve operations mod P, where you have to check if numbers are zero every now and then and do some different operations. If you're adding two points, you get different results if the points are the same or if one point is minus the other. You can boil that down to just a couple cases, but there's still always at least two different cases to check, modulo P. which I believe the claims nevertheless work because all those cases get buried in the 0-0 case that's excluded at the end. I think anything that can happen that's bad gets checked by the XQ not being 0 at the end. But again, there's some gaps in the proof here. I just haven't written down exactly what I'm telling you. What happens in the definition of elliptic curve operations mod n is splitting into more than just those two cases. You have to worry about numbers mod n that are not 0, but they have a factor in common with n. And then you have to split your elliptic curve operations according to the different factors of n, whether that number you were checking, whether it's non-zero or not, whether it has a factor in common with some prime divisor of n and not in common with some other primes dividing n. The definition actually gets a little tricky. And doing the computations actually gets a little tricky, but you can do it. You can check that various numbers are relatively prime to n through your computation. And if you insert that into the definition that I gave of, insert that into the assumptions for the claims, check for each of the xi's and zi's that you use, whether zi is relatively prime to n, and a couple other conditions, then you do get a solid primality proof. I don't like this approach, the standard approach, because, well, it's mathematically messy to be able to say, okay, for every I that you used while going up to Q, for some logarithmic number of I's that showed up in the computation, check some condition. It makes your theorem statement, if you state it properly, kind of long. It also slows down your computation to have to check whether numbers are relatively prime to n. It's at least some extra multiplications at every step in the algorithm, but it does turn the claims that I've made into something proven. I hope that I'll finish off the proof at some point, and then I'll be able to say, okay, there's no more messiness. You don't have to check anything. All the checks you might do get absorbed by checking that x cubed is relatively prime to n. But for the moment, I have to be honest and tell you, this is not yet proof. All right, with the hoped-for clean proofs or the slightly messier, slightly slower proofs that you find in the careful part of the literature, you can check if n is prime, assuming you can prove that n is prime, assuming you've come up with an appropriate curve. Assuming you have a curve, modulo n, which has a point of big prime order q. How do you come up with a curve? Well, the easy answer, the original answer to this question was, you prove the primality of n by trying a bunch of curves. You try a bunch of elliptic curves E, and for each elliptic curve E, you see, okay, is that elliptic curve one that has a point of big prime order q? You write down a random curve E modulo n, and then you use Skolf's algorithm to compute the number of points on the elliptic curve modulo n. Assuming n is prime, Skolf's algorithm is stated as, if n is prime, then the following output computed in this complicated way is the number of points on this elliptic curve mod n. Apply that algorithm. If, of course, n is composite, then, well, the algorithm has no guarantee of working. Obviously, something will fail in your primality proof, and you go back and prove that n is composite instead. Assuming n is prime, then Skolf's algorithm will give you the number of points on this elliptic curve. And then you just check, is it some number that's, say, 2 times a prime? Why the 2? I'll come back to that. Check if the number of points on the curve divided by 2, well, check if it's even, and then if you divide it by 2, check if that number is a prime, q. Check that by trying to prove q composite. If q is, in fact, proven composite, then you keep going to another elliptic curve. If q seems to be prime, then, well, you'll have to prove that prime recursively. Q cannot be bigger than n. When I say prove q is prime recursively, you might worry, hey, what if q is bigger than n? And that's one of the reasons I'm sticking a 2 in here, insisting on not having an elliptic curve whose number of points is exactly prime, but whose number of points is 2 times a prime. That makes q, the prime, be somewhat smaller than n. Remember that the number of points on an elliptic curve mod a prime n is somewhere around n plus 1. N plus 1 plus or minus 2 root n. That's the interval for it. If you take that interval divided by 2, then you get a number smaller than n. Unless, if n is really small, then maybe q might be a little bigger than n. There's some constant that if n is smaller than that constant, then q might be at least as big as n. Or q might be substantially smaller, might be less than or equal to this something around square root of n, where the primality proofs relied on q being bigger than that. This can only happen if n is really tiny, and then just prove it's prime by Chiral division. So assuming that q is smaller than n, making a recursive proof of primality of q makes sense. And bigger than the ceiling of n to the 1 quarter plus 1 squared, which is part of the assumptions of the proof of primality. You need to check that condition. assuming that Q is in the right range, then you recursively prove Q is prime. And then it's easy to write down a point. If you have a curve whose number of points is 2 times Q, then it's very easy to find a point of order Q. Just take any random point and double it, unless you got really unlucky and found a point that was half of infinity, well, infinity, or another point that double it gives you infinity. That's the only points that can fail. And if you bump into that, just try some other point. Then 2 times a point in a group of size 2Q is of order Q. All of these computations can be done. They're perhaps a little bit slow, but they're polynomial time. Sclose algorithm is the original algorithm that caused people to question whether polynomial time was a useful way to understand speed. Sclose algorithm was originally stated as an eighth or I think even ninth power algorithm, which if you really squeeze out all the possible streamlining from it, if you really try to make it as fast as possible, you get down to fifth power, and then there's some improvements subsequently which made it, I believe, fourth power. Don't trust me on that four. The Sclose-Elkies-Atkin algorithm saves, I think, one log factor if you do the asymptotically fast version. In any case, it's something pretty slow, like these sixth power or even fourth power tests that I've been talking about. As n gets big, it's kind of annoying to have twice as many digits in n producing a test that's, say, 32 or 64 or more times slower. We'd like to have something that scales better than just polynomial time with a big exponent. However, Sclose algorithm does work, polynomial time, and if you try it on a bunch of curves, then eventually you will find a prime Q. You will find, well, conjecturally, you'll find a prime Q. We can't prove this. The analytic number theorists can't assure us that there is a prime in the range of elliptic curve sizes divided by 2. This is another question that's kind of like an ERH, maybe GRH question. This is something where if the analytic number theorists prove the Riemann hypothesis and a bit beyond, then they will be able to tell us that, yes, there are some Qs in that range. But for the moment, it's just a reasonable conjecture that you can't have all your primes avoiding such a big range of elliptic curve sizes. Conjecturally, about 1 over log n of all possible numbers are primes in that range. So if you take an elliptic curve size that's even, divide it in half, you will get a prime fairly frequently. You only have to try a logarithmic number of curves until you find a prime. I have a comment here on a practical speed up to get to the state of the art. You don't want to just divide the number of elliptic curve points by 2. You want to allow a 3 or a 6 or a 30 or any smooth number. You want the number of points on the elliptic curve to be something you can factor, which means it should be smooth times a big prime Q. But that smooth number certainly doesn't have to be 2. And if you make it something bigger than 2, if you allow something bigger than 2, then you're allowing more Qs. You're allowing more sizes of elliptic curves mod n to be appropriate numbers. Instead of just 2 times primes, if you also allow any small smooth number times a prime, then, well, you're allowing more elliptic curves. So you reduce the number of curves you have to try. It's still something on the scale of log n, but it's substantially smaller, say log n divided by log log n. You also have to recursively prove that Q is prime. And that recursion involves, well, log n to the 1 plus epsilon levels, because if Q is, say, half as big as n, how many times do you need to divide in half before you get down to small numbers? You need to do it a logarithmic number of times. You can improve that log by, again, allowing the number of points on the elliptic curve to be something bigger than 2 times Q. That makes Q smaller. If you, in fact, insist on Q being smaller, that's something perfectly reasonable, as long as Q is not so small that it's hard to find. If the number of points on E was really hard to factor because Q is some small number, much smaller than n, and then the cofactor is something big that you also don't know, then it would be hard to figure out what Q is, hard to generate this primality proof. But if you allow a pretty big smooth ratio there, any smooth ratio, you have a pretty good chance of finding the number of points on the elliptic curve being smooth times Q, even if you insist that Q be quite a lot smaller than n. Still, the number of levels is something logarithmic in n. The total cost of the algorithm is you need log n levels times log n curves, each of which takes log n to the fifth time to count points on. Overall, to generate one of these quickly verifiable proofs of primality takes log n to the seventh time. the rest of what I'm going to tell you about is better than this log n to the 7th using complex multiplication. I said, hey, let's just look at primality proofs because we're computational number theorists and we don't always have to think about applications to cryptography. CM is interesting beyond primality proofs. That's what I say at the bottom here. But first, let me emphasize the runtime of this small, discriminant, complex multiplication elliptic curve generation method. It has, instead of log n to the 7th time for finding a primality proof, it has what I advertised before, log n to the 4th time for generating a primality proof. Which, if you're not worried about it being conjectured rather than proven, it's just as good as what we can do any other way, and we can verify these primality proofs in only cubic time. Again, that's the state of the art. I said this complex multiplication idea has applications beyond primality. For example, you can use complex multiplication elliptic curves produced by this complex multiplication method that I'll show you. You can use those for pairings. You can generate complex multiplication curves whose embedding degree is small. You heard that that's something, well, depending on exactly what embedding degree you're looking for some security level, that's something which is important for pairing-based cryptography. You can also use CM curves for trying to speed up elliptic curve Diffie-Hellman. There's some ideas for taking advantage of the complex multiplication, the automorphisms in CM curves, in order to speed up Diffie-Hellman, even outside the context of pairing-based cryptography. There's lots of applications of complex multiplication. Another reason that I like complex multiplication, ending off the week here, is you've been hearing all sorts of stuff about elliptic curves, quadratic function fields, and you've been hearing stuff about quadratic number fields. Complex multiplication connects those. There's not just an analogy, there's an actual connection between those, where working with quadratic, imaginary quadratic number fields will tell you something about elliptic curves. All right, how does CM work? What does it do? Well, it generates basically for every prime number n. Again, in generating elliptic curve primality proofs, you assume your number n is prime, and if something goes wrong, then you say, oops, n might have been composite. At the end of the day, you will produce either a compositeness proof or a primality proof. Let's assume we're in the primality case. N is prime here. Z mod n is Fn. It's the finite field of size n. The complex multiplication method will produce for each d, each integer d, well, a few restrictions on it, which I'll go through carefully. For each d, it produces curves mod n with a known number of points. All right, there's certain restrictions on d. It has to be a positive integer, which will give us an imaginary quadratic number field, q adjoint square root of minus d. D has to be 3 mod 4. Well, okay, it doesn't actually have to be 3 mod 4, but that's a lot of d's. It's good enough for what I'm going to say. There's various ways to streamline this method that involve looking at more d's. You have more chances for CM to give you a nice curve. But it's good enough to understand the method for d being 3 mod 4 to believe what I've said about the log n to the 4th. That'll come from just looking at these that are 3 mod 4. It has to be square free. This is something else where, okay, it doesn't actually have to be square free. This is some fraction of the d's, not all the d's, and you can gain speed by looking at some more d's. But I'll assume d is positive, square free, 3 mod 4. And here's a critical restriction that you cannot get around. The n's that work for a given d are only the n's that look like u squared plus dv squared divided by 4. And you should be looking at that u squared plus dv squared and saying, that's a norm from q adjoint square root of minus d. This is the norm of u plus root minus dv. All right, under these restrictions on n and d, the complex multiplication elliptic curve generation method will give you a curve, which is called a curve with complex multiplication by q adjoint square root of minus d, reduced modulo n, which has a known number of points. If you know what the u is inside that n equals u squared plus dv squared over 4. That tells you how many points are on this curve, modulo n, produced quickly by the complex multiplication method. How quickly? Well, I'm going to assume d is quadratic in the log of n. This is a typical range of d. Sometimes, in a lot of applications, people will just look at single d's, like d is minus 3, or d is minus 7. D is 3 or 7. So the field is q adjoint square root of minus 3 or q adjoint square root of minus 7. In elliptic curve primality proving and some other applications, you allow d to be somewhat bigger. Let's say quadratic in the number of bits of n. Assuming d is about that big, then the time for the complex multiplication method to generate a curve is just a little bit bigger than d. I wrote down here, the method I'll tell you is log n to the 2.5 to generate a CM curve. You can do better, you can get that 2.5 down to 2, but this won't be necessary for the exponent 4 of elliptic curve primality proving, so I'll just show you the simplified algorithm that people tend to use, which is not quite the fastest algorithm.
So, can we get this right? For a given n, you start incrementing d until you get something that works?
Okay, which d's you look at was the question. Do you just go through the d's in order? You could do that. FastDCPP does something more subtle, which I'll get through carefully after I've said CM for a given d. Let's just assume for now that we've got n, and we've got some d that's not too big, and it satisfies these conditions, and then I'll come back to how do we look for the d's, how do we take advantage of these conditions in primality proving. For the moment, it's just we're trying to make a curve modulo n, which has this number of points, and we're also supplied with a d, where n is u squared plus dv squared over 4. Okay, under these assumptions, the first step in the CM method is to write down a whole bunch of integers, a, b, c, that are relatively prime, that have minus d being b squared minus 4ac, that have b, an absolute value, being at most a, which is at most c, and if b is negative, some extra restrictions. You should recognize this. What are these a's, b's, and c's? Shout it out. Come on. You know this. Yeah, exactly. These are forms under these reduced and primitive and whatever restrictions on forms. This is enumerating the class group of Q adjoint square root of minus d. These A, B's, and C's represent the class group of Q adjoint square root of minus d in the forms language. And, well, these are something that you can easily write down. You've heard about all sorts of subtle methods of computing class groups quickly. Here we want to enumerate the class group. Just write down all the A's, B's, and C's. And that's something you can do by just trying all the A's, B's, and C's. Well, okay, maybe that's a little bit too slow. But you can try every B if you like, and then try every A. And that would be fast enough to fit within how fast CM is. Other steps in the algorithm will be slower. I've written down something which is maybe overkill here. Try every B in the range you've heard. You know that absolute value of A and absolute value of B are at most square root of 1/3 of D. So try every integer b in that range, easily follows from the inequalities. And then what is a? A is what? A is a factor of b squared plus d. B squared plus d is equal to 4ac. So a has to be some factor of b squared plus d. Find all of the small prime factors, and that easily tells you all of the small factors of b squared plus d. That tells you all the possibilities for a. You know a limited range for a. This is something where the time for this is essentially linear in the number of b's. You can do this in time basically square root of d, but even if you just ran through every possible a in the right range, it would take time only about d, and, well, okay, got to be a little careful to fit within the log n to the 2.5 considering the time for arithmetic, but you can easily do this computation, enumerating the class group of q adjoint root minus d in less time than the other steps I'll tell you about.
And this could be done as a pre-computation, right? You can do it for the first a million d's, right?
Question was, can you do this as a pre-computation? Once upon a time, yes, you could, because people were only doing elliptic curve primality proving for small numbers. However, nowadays, people are looking at d's that have 10 digits or more, and nobody actually wants to write down a table. It's so fast to compute the class group and to do the other CM computations that you might as well do it on the fly. It's a relic of the old versions of elliptic curve primality proving that people were building big databases of CM information like these class enumerated class groups and then the HD that I'll talk about in a moment. People were making tables of those, which it's nice to have tables that say how big those are so somebody can look through and find interesting D's for making conjectures. So it's nice to have tables of class numbers. But actually writing down the information, complete information produced by CM, it's so fast to regenerate that nobody actually makes tables anymore. All right, here's where things start getting a little bit weird. There's a function called J, which is, I assert, defined on this slide. It has as input a complex number. It has as output a complex number. At least, let's assume the input is some complex number with positive imaginary part, and that'll make the rest of the discussion easier. The inputs that I am giving to J are minus V over 2A plus the imaginary number square root of minus D divided by 2A. That is something with positive imaginary part. If I take the positive imaginary, take I, the usual square root of minus 1 times the square root of D in the positive direction, there's something which satisfies the condition I just said on J. I'll say in a moment why that's important. J is defined as, wow, there's all these wacky formulas. So here is, the formulas are actually, there's all sorts of interesting number theoretic information encoded in these. There's pentagonal number theorem, there's theta functions, there's all sorts of interesting functions. What I say is wacky here on the slide is the names for these functions, but they're very standard, so I feel compelled to stick to them. Q of z is defined as e to the 2 pi I z. Later on, we're going to have a Q of z over 2 implicitly, and that's e to the 2 pi, pi I z. So Q of z is what? Q of z is a point on the unit circle. Well, if z were real, then Q of z would be a point on the unit circle. My z's, J of z is the quantity inside J there. Z is something that has positive imaginary part. If you look at the inequality, significantly positive imaginary part, which if you multiply by I, gives you a number that has significantly negative real part. And then if you exponentiate, you get a number Q that's significantly inside the unit circle. That's important because I'm going to be computing sums with big powers of Q, and I want those sums to converge. This is the most complicated part of the definition of J. Something called eta to the 24th is Q times 1 plus the sum of minus 1 to the I, Q to the I times 3i minus 1 over 2 plus the same thing with 3i plus 1 over 2. All that parenthesized quantity to the 24th, again, times the original Q, that's called eta to the 24th. And while you don't need eta, you could take some 24th roots here, but they won't show up anywhere else in the definition of J, so let's just do eta to the 24th. Again, Q is inside the unit circle, so these big powers of Q, these sums converge. Something called F1 to the 24th, and at this point, I don't even want to try to give you a hint of what F2 and so on might be. There's some function which in the Dark Ages was called F1 to the 24th, and we still live in the Dark Ages. This is eta to the 24th applied to z over 2. I have to plug z over 2 into a q, and then put that into the eta to the 24th formula, divided by the eta to the 24th of z, where you just plug in z everywhere in the formula. Finally, j, applied to a complex number z, is defined as the cube of f1 of z to the 24th plus 16, and then divide again by f1 to the 24th, obviously. Now, these are all sorts of complicated functions that carry some amazing number theoretic information. I'm just going to make some assertions about the things that these do for us in CM, and, well, we'll be happy with those for elliptic curve primality proving. You can check the results much more easily than checking the proofs that these things have something to do with elliptic curves, but okay, there's a definition of a function J. I hope by my comments about Q I've convinced you that at least these sums converge and these functions are defined when Z, in particular, the input to J that I've written on the second line of that slide, when Z has positive imaginary part. I said compute this J to high precision, and I haven't said what high means. Well, the number of bits that we're going to need for CM to work is something like log n. Something like square root of d. I said d was up to the square of log n. Number of bits we need here is about the square root of d, log n to the 1 plus epsilon. And that tells you also how many of the terms in this eta sum you need. The sum of q to the I squared, roughly. How big, if q is significantly inside the unit circle, let's say q is a half, and you want to have that sum to, say, a million bits of precision, then you need to take your q to the power a million or so. So I squared has to be something like a million. I has to be at least 1,000. The number of terms in the eta sum that you need in order for the truncation to not be noticeable with log n bits of precision, the number of I terms that you need is about square root of log n, square root of the precision. The number of A's, B's, and C's that we're feeding to the J there is at most about log n. The size of the class group is about square root of D. That's something you've heard. And now I should pause and ask again what the soccer script is.
1-1.
That would explain the smiles. Okay, it seems to be tied. 1-1.
It's not sudden death, is it?
Sudden death, that would seem to be my talk here. Well, okay, I'm almost done. The number of inputs, the size of the class group, you know, is about square root of d, that's about log n, and multiplying all these together, the total time to do arithmetic is essentially linear, and the size of data you write down, the total time to evaluate j to compute exponentials of complex numbers, that's something you can do to high precision very quickly. It's like multiplication and division. It's a little more complicated, but you can do all these computations in comparable time to the total size of the data you're writing down, including all the terms in the sum. The total time looks like log n to the 2.5. That's the bottleneck in the algorithm. That's where you can do fancier algorithms that are even faster, but this will be good enough for elliptic curve primality proving. I have a comment here that you don't actually have to think about what the precision is. You might complain if I say compute to high precision, you want to write software, you have to choose the precision. But no, you don't. You can just start with some guess for the precision. If it's not enough, you'll see that later on, and then you can try twice the precision and keep going until you have enough precision.
Is this all done in floating point?
Yes, this is done in complex floating point arithmetic. Not just to 64 bits. This, you should do these computations to hundreds, thousands, depending on how big n is. Well, roughly you need log n to the 1 plus something bits. A lot of the fancy stuff, there are many papers on this topic, a lot of the things people do are trying to reduce the precision by, say, a factor of 10, speeding everything up by at least a factor of 10. That's certainly valuable, but it doesn't change the asymptotics. And CN, even the way that I've stated it, is so fast that it won't be a bottleneck in primality proving. I'm almost done with CM, and then I just need a bit more to finish off ACPP. You take all those J values, you take X, a polynomial variable, minus the J values, multiply them together over all the A, Bs, and Cs in the class group, representatives of the class group, and that gives you a polynomial with complex coefficients, which is normally called H sub minus D, for instance, H sub minus 23. Amazing fact, which I'm certainly not going to prove, is that this is actually an integer polynomial. And that's one of the things that lets, well, this is enough to let you recognize if you have enough precision. You can keep track of how accurate your complex computations are, and then once you've computed h sub minus d, ask if the bounds you have on your coefficients of h sub minus d are less than a half. They put you close to an integer. Or you just look at the h sub minus d's and see if you have a number that looks like 14.00001, then, yeah, you have enough precision, whereas if you have a number like 3.14159, then you better check your random number generator. No, you don't have enough precision. Anyway, you can easily use this fact about h sub minus d to check if you had enough precision. This means all the j's are roots of an integer polynomial. They're algebraic integers, and there's all sorts of theory, class field theory, that tells you what's going on with these j's, which I'm not going to care about. I'll just assert it's true. And hey, maybe it's motivation to learn some more number theory. The cost of doing this computation is less than the 2.5 power time that I said before, using, again, fast arithmetic. And now here's the curve. Here's the curve that has the advertised number of points. You just compute a root of this h sub minus d modulo n, n being prime. That's something you can do quickly, as you heard last week. And now here's a completely explicit curve, an elliptic curve that modulo n has n plus 1 plus u or minus u or whatever. There's some numbers that you can stick into the u squared plus dv squared, not very many numbers, that give you 4n. And the u components of those tell you the number of points on this curve. To finish this off, I need a few slides to tell you applying this to elliptic curve primality proving. I think since I started a few minutes late, I will actually end on time here. The d's that you look at are going to be y smooth numbers. Y here, okay, I shouldn't have used that for both smoothness and the y coordinates on a curve. Y is something like log n. We're going to look at log n smooth d's up to the square of log n. In order to use the u and v, in order to figure out the u and v, you need to know square roots of minus d, and that's the initial computation in elliptic curve primality proving. In finding an elliptic curve primality proof, is to compute square roots of lots of numbers, potential d's. Compute square roots of all the primes up to y, all the primes up to log n, along with the square root of minus 1. Those might not have square roots mod this prime n, but just extend the field z mod n to a quadratic extension, and then you heard last week how to compute square roots in the quadratic extension. They all have square roots there. Each of the square root computations is quadratic time. Asymptotically, the total cost of this step is cubic time, because there's a linear number of primes, quadratic number of operations per square root. And then the d's you look at, it's not quite sequential d's, you just look at the smooth d's up to the square of log n, same limit I said before. You figure out the square roots of minus d, which again you're going to need for the u's and v's, by multiplying square roots of the primes that divide d. If d is, say, 15, then you figure out a square root of minus 15 by multiplying square root of minus 1, square root of 3, and square root of 5. The reason to do that multiplication instead of doing square roots separately is that multiplication is a lot faster than square roots. It takes just log n to the 1-bit operations to do enough multiplications to find the square root of minus d, starting from the known square roots of primes. The number of d's is log squared, so the total cost here is, again, log n cubed. Jeff Shalit doesn't get enough credit for this particular trick of speeding up elliptic curve primality proving. It used to be people would compute the square roots of minus d's all separately, and that was a bottleneck in the entire algorithm. You then figure out the u's and v's. Well, there's an algorithm called Kornacki's algorithm. It's another example of lattice basis reduction, if you don't have enough motivation to learn about that. That's something where, starting from a square root of minus d, you can figure out u and v, such that u squared plus dv squared is 4n. I'll just assert, without going through the details of that algorithm, that it's again something that takes essentially linear time for each d, quadratic number of d's, total time is cubic. You then, without having applied CM yet, you then restrict attention to numbers of points on elliptic curves where the numbers have the right form. 2 times q, or as before, some smooth number times q, more flexible, faster. You look for what you know are going to be the number of points coming out of CM, n plus 1 plus or minus u. You look for that being 2 times a prime, or in general, smooth times a prime, easily factored number. Hey, this is a good application of finding small factors of integers. And actually, this CM ECPP application is where some of the fastest smooth finding small factors algorithms were developed. Another side application of pure computational number theory. Anyway, I didn't do it, so I get to praise it. You look at the bunch of n plus 1 plus or minus u's, you divide out 2 or whatever smooth numbers come to mind, that you look at those numbers, divide out small prime factors, look for primes, and there will occasionally be some primes. You check each of those resulting q's to see whether it's prime by trying to prove it composite. Compositeness proving is slow, but there's not very many choices of d that survive. And here I'm relying on another fact about class numbers, that they're about log n size. As you've heard, they're about square root of d size, which reduces the number of u's and v's you have to look at down to log. Then each compositeness proof, each primality test, costs log n squared by SPRP test for, again, a total time of log n cubed. Second to last slide. We're almost through the week. You now use the CM method to write down a curve. You take, hopefully there's going to be a prime q. If you look at how likely this procedure is to succeed, then you see that, well, there's going to be maybe some d's that work. In practice, if you juggle the parameters a bit, you find there's, say, one duvq that works, where d is appropriate, u and v have u squared plus dv squared being 4n, and q being a big prime that you know dividing n plus 1 plus u. You look at those duvqs and use the CM method to write down a curve, which is your certificate for a primality proof, to write down a curve whose order, whose number of points, is divisible by q. Things might go wrong. You might actually have n plus 1 plus u or minus u. You don't know when you go through the method unless you really think about it. You don't know whether you're going to get n plus 1 plus a particular root of the u squared plus dv squared or some other root like minus. You might also find that the shape of curves for doing computations quickly on the curve is not suitable for the y squared equals x cubed plus something that you wrote down from the CM method. But some of the time, this is the sort of thing that might exclude 75% of the curves you look at. And you can deal with those issues, or you can just try 4 or 5 curves. And eventually, you'll find one that works. And that's enough. that has in cubic time generated for n a primality proof, an appropriate curve. You know the number of points. You can easily write down a point on the curve that has order q by taking a random point and multiplying it by the size b divided by q, and then recursively prove q is prime, conclude that n is prime. Oops, the log n cubed that I said is not the final complexity because we need a bunch of recursive primality proofs. There's again log n number of levels of recursion. Multiplying that by log cubed, we get log n to the fourth time for constructing the primality proof. The wonderful advantage of elliptic curve primality proving, last line of all my slides here, the wonderful advantage of elliptic curve primality proving over the AKS type test that we have now or all the other tests out there is that the verification time for the primality proofs is small. Verifying the elliptic curve computations once you have a curve and a point, then checking that saves a log factor compared to constructing it. You can verify these primality proofs in essentially cubic time. All right, I stated lots of open questions. Hope I've given you a taste of what's going on in primality proving and a taste of some of the things you see as you go on in algebraic and other number theory. And that's it for me. Thank you for your attention. Hey, what's the soccer score?
Same.
Still 1-1. 1-1 in the second half.
Well,
what a surprising
sound.
They're in overtime.
Second quarter overtime.
Wow, okay.
There was a fantastic goal by Closer. You missed it.
I missed. Oh my god, why couldn't you turn the laptop this way? Elliptic curve, whoa, look at that!
You know, we could just feed it to the projector.
Yeah, it was done before. Why didn't that work?
I don't know. Old laptop, maybe.
So, did anybody have questions about primality proving?
Sorry.
Yeah. Oh, just hand
there
us a note. Okay.
Old theorem of Pratt that gives a certificate for primality. Can you tell me how much time it takes to find and how much time it takes to verify that one? I don't quite.
Yeah. So the question was about Pratt's primality proof, and that is like what you get out of the elliptic curve primality proofs that are very hard to find. Pratt is also like that. So here we go. Variant. Some of the things you can do with these elliptic or hyperelliptic curve type primality proofs, instead of looking for a prime q, if you look for a power of 2 q, which oops is not prime, but you can deal with that, you get these elliptic curves with large power of 2 factors, and those are actually faster to verify. Because q is a power of 2, you don't have to prove its primality recursively. That saves a log factor. You were asking about Pratt's proof, and that has the same flavor as this. There exists a certificate by Pratt that proves the primality of n. Really, it's Pocklington's theorem, that there exists a reasonably short primality proof for n. The cost of that proof, the Pocklington-type proof, is log n cubed instead of log n squared. There's a conjecture that, if you believe it, would imply that you could find similar kinds of proofs that take only log n squared, but we haven't proven that cost for verifying certificates by Pocklington-type proofs. What Pratt did, Pratt proved that primes is in NP, that there's short certificates, polynomial-sized certificates of primality, and that's just a reformulation of Pocklington's idea, analyzing the speed of Pocklington's algorithm for proving primality. That, again, is not as good as this theorem. This is a theorem of Pomerantz, so you get quadratic time, provably, don't have to make any conjectures, you get quadratic time, verification of primality. The open question is now, can we get better than quadratic time? Pratt was only provably cubic time and conjecturally quadratic time. If you're interested in references, I've been systematically suppressing references. I had, I think, one name on my slides, namely a graduate student name, but if you want to know where all these algorithms come from, what you should read for further information, I have a survey paper which has the title something like Distinguishing Prime Numbers from Composite Numbers, the State of the Art in 2004. There have been some slight improvements since then, for instance, in ECPP, so you should read the more recent stuff from 2005, 2006 on fast ECPP, but you can get all of the algorithms I've talked about except for the latest ECPP news. You can get that from my survey paper. I also have a web page which goes through almost all the algorithms. Pratt is something which again, that's Pocklington type primality proofs. They're awfully difficult to find because you have to factor, let me just say what it is algebraically. Instead of using an elliptic curve mod n, you use the unit group mod n. So instead of having to find an elliptic curve with a large prime factor, you have to find n minus 1. There's only one choice for that, with a large prime factor. And, well, the only way we have to find that prime factor is do a big factorization. So it takes a long time to find a Pocklington-type primality proof. I think you heard about Pocklington before ECM last week. At least that's what I saw on some slides. The elliptic curve version of it, again, very slow to find in this variation by Pomerantz, but it takes quadratic time to verify. Okay, more questions about primality proving. Yeah?
Not about primality. This is about tomorrow.
Soccer? No, tomorrow. Okay.
No. The latest message from Michael about the Beetaloo trip, you can read on the email. Is someone else preparing this? So, yeah, you want to say then?
Yeah. I want to say a few things, but first let's finish him.
Yeah. Okay.
So, excuse me.
Were there more questions?
Yeah. What did you like about the latest about primality test for Fermat numbers?
Oh, the question was about primality tests for Fermat numbers. There, something I've not covered at all is, are there numbers n where these tests are significantly faster?
Yeah.
Certainly from factorization, you expect that some numbers are much easier, lots of numbers are much easier to factor than other numbers. You actually have to do a bit of work to come up with a number that's really hard to factor. You have to generate big prime factors of it. For primality, there's much less of that effect, but there are still some numbers that are easier, and in the case of Fermat numbers and Mersenne numbers, much easier to check for primality than general numbers. If you're interested in those special cases, well, you can look at the GIMP's Great Internet Mersenne Prime Search. They also have information about Fermat prime tests. It's, instead of cubic time, basically quadratic time to verify those special numbers for primality. Those are cases where Pocklington-type proofs are very easy to find because n minus 1, for example, is very easy to factor. These elliptic curve primality tests and the other complicated tests that I've talked about are more important if you have a general number where you don't have any special structure that lets you easily generate a primality proof. If you're interested in what happens for special numbers, again, look at what people have written about the Mersenne prime search or the Fermat search. The rough summary is you get down to quadratic time instead of cubic time, both for finding and verifying the proof. But that's something I haven't covered at all, and also in my paper I haven't covered it, so you'll have to look at other papers about that. All right, if there are no more questions, then let me say thanks one last time for your attention.